Lewis versus the State of Minnesota. And we are ready for oral argument when counsel are. Would each of you be sure to introduce yourself for the record before each leg of your argument?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, James Lewis. Your Honor, in a criminal case, criminal defendants get two choices when they get an offer from the prosecutor: accept or reject. Those are the options that are available to the defendant from the moment the case starts until the jury returns a verdict, to accept or reject the state's offer. So when we're looking at prejudice in an ineffective case, we need to analyze counsel's professional error in the context of the only two choices that the defendant has in a criminal case: to accept the prosecutor's offer or reject the prosecutor's offer. So when we're talking about prejudice here, we're talking about whether Mr. Lewis, in the context of being affirmatively misadvised by his attorney, whether there's a reasonable likelihood that he would have rejected option one and proceeded to trial, or rejected option one and in favor of accepting option two. So the problem with...
You know, when you say affirmatively misadvised, I mean, at the sentencing, the prosecutor did say, okay, you know, I think it's 25. Mm-hmm. I think that was the magic number. So where is the evidence in the record of affirmative misadvice?
We are presuming in the first instance that defense counsel advised his client that option two would result in a presumptive 55 and a half months.
And we should presume that because why now?
Because counsel has an affirmative duty to advise their client in the first instance of offers made by the state.
Okay, so then get to sentencing. Everyone thought, what did everybody think the presumptive sentence was on the second count? Turned out to be mistaken on.
Well, there's a problem with the premise of the question, Your Honor. Respectfully,
okay.
Count two in the offer that Mr. Lewis accepted, it's a different crime than the crime in option two. So
because it's attempt?
Because it's attempt.
All right, so they offered him attempt, executed sentence, 55 months, when in fact it would have been 25 months.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what evidence is there that the prosecutor would have stood by that offer? If the basis of the offer was, based on your criminal history score, we're offering you attempt 55 months, and then they get to sentencing, and it's like, nope, turns out prosecutor's wrong, it's 25 months. What evidence is there that the prosecutor would have said, okay, the new offer is 25 months?
I don't mean to not answer the question. The point is that far and beyond exceeds the scope of the prejudice analysis under Strickland. You look at what the defendant would have done had he been properly advised. Is there a reasonable likelihood that he would have pled to a different charge or rejected all of the options?
The problem I'm having is the prosecutor made an offer for a different charge. If the prosecutor hadn't done that, the prosecutor could have just said, okay, well, I'll give you 55 months downward departure as charged.
Your Honor, that is the problem with that analysis, is it goes down the cascade of what-ifs.
Okay. So let me just, I'll ask one more question, then I'll stop. What if we reverse and remanded for an evidentiary hearing and the prosecutor shows up and testifies under oath, there's no way I would have offered 55 months if I had known the correct criminal history score? Doesn't that get us right where we are today?
No. And the reason it does not is because it does not bear on Mr. Lewis's decision whether to accept or reject option one or option two, because the prosecutor's subsequent action could be, okay, mea culpa, I'm okay with 25 and a half months. They could also say, there's no way I would have given him that short of a sentence. this is the cascade of what-ifs that I'm pushing back against.
You know, and that's fair. But, I mean, if the prosecutor testifies, I would never have given your client 25 months. Explain to me how you win then.
Because I'm talking about the scope.
Or is the idea that, who knows, that's why we want an evidentiary hearing, maybe the prosecutor will say something else. Is that the bottom line?
I suppose I could give a general answer like that. Respectfully, I think it's kind of glib, right? I think, to be candid here, we're looking at the proper analysis under the prejudice prong, and it's the only two options the defendant gets to make at the time the offer is presented to him, accept or reject.
Well, weren't the only two options really prison and probation? I mean, you know, that's generally, and unless things have changed dramatically, most of the time, the clients take probation because who in his right mind would want to go to prison? I mean, so that's really, I mean, was it really prison or probation?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean.
How was it not? Because option one was dispositional departure, probation. Option two was executed prison sentence.
It depends on how Mr. Lewis testifies that he perceived the offer that as communicated by his lawyer, and how he would have perceived the offer had he been accurately advised by his attorney.
Because how could he, if just the big picture is, offer one was for probation, offer two was an executed prison sentence. How could he perceive those two options any differently?
20 months of pretrial incarceration.
Minus a third.
20 months of pretrial incarceration, and the presumptive sentence is 25 months. What, 5 years or 5 months of supervision against 5 years of probation and the sword of Damocles over his head?
You're right. A lot of people under that circumstances might would have gone for the 18 months as opposed to, you know, the other one.
Your division's better in mind, but yeah.
The other question I have, counsel, is, you know, we do have to assume that, well, do we have to assume under your scenario that the prosecutor would have offered less than 55 months?
No.
Okay, why not?
Because we're looking at the duty of counsel to do more than just communicate the terms. Defense counsel, I mean, the Guidelines Commission works so hard to set these severity levels and to make the severity levels proportionate for the with the offense, and then defense counsel has to go and look at what the presumptive sentence is in the context of the offer made by the state, because the offer isn't just 55 and a half months. That's only reading the second half of the sentence. It's a material term.
But isn't there only prejudice if, okay, I agree with you, the defense attorney should be knowing the presumptive, correct presumptive sentence, although if some criminal history scores are often assumed and then they turn out to be wrong. But let's say this defense attorney did do his homework, his or her, and concluded, you know what, this 55 months, it's really 25 months, and he tells that to his client, and then they show up, and they say, we'll take option two. And at that point, probation's there with the criminal history score saying, well, you know what, it's not 55, it's 25. And, I mean, unless we assume the prosecutor would have said, well, yes, you're right, I'm going to stick by 25. If there's a chance the prosecutor then says, well, I'm not going forward with the deal, and not only the prosecutor, but the court, because the court ultimately decides whether or not to accept a plea based on the terms of the plea agreement. So what makes us think this district court judge would have said, okay, well, if the new agreement is 25 months and he's got 20 months of credit, I'm not signing off on that. I mean, don't we need to find both that the prosecutor would have agreed to it and the district court would have agreed to it?
My head is spinning by all the possibilities of how this case could have progressed had defense counsel properly advised his client, and then the client can choose accept or reject.
Okay.
After
then,
that,
here's the thing. Your client rejected 55 months. So if he wants the 55 months, he should get the 55 months. Why does he get to have 25 months? Because it's essentially like, well, that 55 months wasn't a valid offer because it doesn't reflect an accurate criminal history score.
The remedy, Your Honor, in Cooper was to allow Mr. Lewis to accept or reject the terms offered by the state. That offer was attempted second-degree crim sex and 55 and a half months. That's the whole sentence, not just the number. And he can choose to accept it if the conviction is reversed. And then, yes, maybe the court rejects it subsequently. Maybe the state concedes and says it should be 25 and a half. Maybe the state asks to blow up the whole plea agreement. There's a whole cascade of what ifs, and all that demonstrates is that there is a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been
different.
And
that was helpful, because are you saying that the relief you're seeking is the 55 months or the 25 months?
Just to accept or reject the offer on its terms.
Okay. So you're saying he should be able to go with option 2 at this point, which was 55 months.
Mr. Lewis should have the opportunity to accept or reject option 2. And those are the only choices that he had at the time of counsel's professional error.
Option 2, which was not offered, but should have been.
No.
Option 2 was offered.
Let's just cut to the chase. You're saying your client wants the opportunity to say, I want option 2, my sentence is 55 months. That's what the agreement was, I want that 55 months.
He might say that. He also might present to the judge that that's an unlawful sentence and maybe renegotiate for a double upward departure, right? And then he could get to 55 months. The state was really implying in their brief that they would do anything it took to get to that magic arbitrary number, no disrespect. But the point is that the remedy is to cure the professional error, to give him the opportunity to accept or reject the terms with the proper advice from counsel, which includes the presumptive sentence. And that might be, hey, I agreed to 55 months, I should get 55 months. Hey, that might be 25 and a half months. But that's part of that what-if cascade that happens after he accepts option 2.
So what if, so at the hearing, when the prosecutor said, well, you know, it's really 25 months, what would have happened if his lawyer said, okay, so it's 25 months, but they're still not offering you that. They're offering you 55. What do you want to do?
That would be different advice. Then they wouldn't have a professional error.
So the error at sentencing was the lawyer didn't say, hey, this is different now. They've got to... You need to plead to something else other than attempt if they want 55.
That's right. Part of the prejudice recognizes that there is a potential to renegotiate the outcome of this case, right? But we start with the professional error and look at the options that the defendant had. That impacts the outcome of the case. That's the reasonable probability.
I know I said one last question, but this is fascinating to me because... All right, so let's say you're at the sentencing hearing as Judge Connolly has proposed, and it's made clear to everybody in the courtroom, including your client, that the presumptive sentence for option 2 is actually 25 months?
I would push back pretty hard on clear to my client with an IQ in his 60s and civilly committed very shortly after, and Jarvis ordered clear to my client is a pretty nebulous concept, technically competent but not sophisticated. So
well,
I think he really
this.
Needs...
Was your client in the room to hear a discussion on the record about the fact that the presumptive sentence for option 2 is really 25 months and not 55?
Yes, he was in the room. I think it requires a greater degree of sophistication to connect this error and the severity levels that's brought up in the abstract by the prosecutor to the judge and then connect it to option 2 to recognize that the attempt would have been to a
what
lesser
did the
degree.
Lawyer say? Did the lawyer say, you know what, we want to take a recess, I want to talk to my client?
Nothing. We're good, Judge. Plain acquiescence.
So... what you want today is for us to reverse and have an evidentiary hearing, mm-hmm. correct?
That's all I'm asking, Your Honor. Okay.
And then, as you put it, the cascade of events will flow from that evidentiary hearing.
That's right.
Do you really think your client appreciated whether it was attempt or not, and really the only thing he was focusing on was probation, 55 months prison. And it didn't matter what he was pleading to. It was probation, 55 months. You're saying it did matter to him.
The factual assertion in the petition that the judge failed to adequately apply under the prejudice analysis was that he would not have pleaded guilty to option one. He would have chose option two had he been properly advised.
And you're really, I mean, at the end of the day, you're just saying you've got to assume the facts in the post-conviction proceeding in the way they're presented by the petitioner. And if there is any possibility that the petitioner could get relief, you give him a hearing. And that didn't happen here.
I completely agree, Your Honor. I'll address the rest of the questions on rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent Respondent State of Minnesota in this matter. The post-conviction court acted well within its discretion when it denied a hearing on this claim. The post-conviction court carefully considered the claims raised by the appellant, granted a hearing on one of the claims that did present material factual disputes that warranted a development of the facts, but denied a hearing on this claim.
And were both claims in the same petition?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant.
Why didn't the district court judge just have a hearing on both claims?
That's a question for the post-conviction court. The question for this court is whether it was an abuse of discretion or not when the court made that decision. But I think because the appellant did not allege facts that would, if proven, would entitle him to relief. And because the files, petition, and record conclusively show that he's not entitled to plea withdrawal on this claim, he was not entitled to a hearing, and a hearing would not be helpful in this case.
Don't we, Ms. Light, don't we have to assume a lot in order to get where you want us to go? And didn't the district court seem to assume a lot? I mean, it's basically saying, well, the prosecutor never would have offered anything less than 55 months because of the natures of this crime. And, you know, that may be true, but, I mean, and maybe the district court, maybe the prosecutor would have, you know, tweaked it and it, you know, he pled to something else and somehow you would have gotten 55 months. But, you know, we don't know that. And it just seems to me the district court is really sort of going beyond the plain petition and the law to get where it wants to go, to assume that you were, that it was going to be 55 months come hell or high water.
And I believe, you know, appellant's argument on that point is that the district court has made these credibility determinations that are improper without an evidentiary hearing.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't even say it's credibility determinations. I think it's just, it's assuming facts, not in evidence.
And my response to that is I believe that the post-conviction court's ruling is based on the record and coupled with common sense. When you look at the
record.
Well,
I'm all in favor of that. but.
When you look at the record, the previous offer had been 60 months. There is nothing in the record that would ever show that
and
the state
was
would go significantly.
60 months pleading to what? I assume not the attempt.
Correct.
Okay.
So, and I don't know if it's in the record explicitly. There was a pretrial hearing that I cite in my brief where the state puts the offer on the record that it was 60 months. And when under the guidelines with appellant's criminal history score of guideline sentence under count two, the second degree criminal sexual conduct, a guideline sentence would be 60 months.
How is this not, I mean, what, one problem I have with what happened at the hearing is, okay, good for the prosecutor to say, hey, you know, based on the attempt, it's 25, but how is it not malpractice for the appellant's counsel to permit his client to be sentenced illegally? I mean, this was not a proper sentence, right? I mean, the sentence for the attempt is not 55 and a half, it's 25.
He wasn't sentenced under the attempt.
Okay.
So the offer in the email right before the plea hearing was option one, 199 months stayed, get on probation. Option two, 55 months, we'll get there by you plead to an attempt on count two. Appellant took.
And he pled to that.
Appellant took option one.
Right, so I'm sorry. I apologize.
So he pled to count one and count two, completed offenses. I believe he was sentenced to a guideline sentence on count two, and then it was Hernandez to get to the 199 months, and then those were both dispositionally departed so that he could get probation. So he never pled or
Fair
was
enough.
Convicted on attempt.
So it wasn't. So it wasn't malpractice to remain silent because under your scenario, he was never going to get 25 months. It was always going to be 55 and a half. And you would have, well, the prosecutor would have found, well, you know, he would have been rearranged or something, and, you know, or the someone would have provided grounds for an upward departure, blah, blah, blah.
Correct. I think.
And we know that because why now?
Because appellant
because
accepted.
Based on silence, and we know that Hennepin County knows how to get to 55 months somehow.
Because the defense attorney understood the plea offers. He understood the two options. He understood one was probation with 199 months hanging over your head, and that the other option was 55 months executed. He knew, and then when it was clarified on the record, prior to acceptance of the plea, prior to conviction, prior to sentencing, this is actually a severity level B or D offense, and they corrected it, and the sentencing moved forward. The record just shows that it never would have gone down the rabbit hole that appellant has been talking about of all the different possibilities.
But that does assume that the state would not have offered 25 and would have gotten to 55 and a half some other way.
Correct. And so I think that's...
And how do we know that without a prosecutor saying that under oath at an evidentiary hearing?
Sure.
Even though I believe, I would bet $100 that the prosecutor at an evidentiary is going to say...
No way
it was going to be 25 and a half. It was going to be 55 and we would have done, you know, some triple somersault, durational, downward, upward,
and
to get to 55. Or he would have been rearranged and pled to something else, blah, blah, blah. But
and
it
so
would have been 55.
And so if, when they discovered the correct subdivision that he was actually charged under that actually fit his offense, and looking at the guidelines, the guideline sentence for that offense is 60 months with his two criminal history points.
Right.
So, and 55 would have been right in that range, so they wouldn't have had to bend over backwards at all. It would have been a presumptive guideline sentence. You know, I think looking at the record and then applying logic and common sense.
But doesn't he still have to have the opportunity to consider the plea offer, whatever they would have decided, whether they would have said, sure, take the 25, or they would have said, no, that was our mistake, we're going to change it now. So we're at least at 55, if not 60. Doesn't the defendant still have to have the opportunity to be advised fully of what that other plea offer was before making a decision? And if not, why?
I think because that goes to the prejudice prong of the Strickland analysis of looking at would the outcome have been different had, you know, he had
that
opportunity.
So tell me about that. Speak more about that.
Yeah. So I think So, you know, it kind of depends on where you believe that the defense attorney went, where his representation was deficient. If you think, you know, when the plea offer email came in, he should have immediately been like, nope, like that's, you know, attempted CrimSex 2, that's 25 and a half months. You should definitely take that right now. We'll try to, you know, it depends on how that conversation and guidance would have come from the defense attorney to the client, or if it would have been at sentencing when it was clarified on the record and the defense attorney said, hold on, we need to have a break, I need to talk to my client, we need to know if this changes his decision today.
Did that happen?
No. I believe, and I have the sentencing transcript over there, I believe the defense attorney said, you know, that's correct, Your Honor, when the prosecutor clarified on the record.
Did anybody ask, did the judge ask the defendant, well, it looks like your criminal history score was wrong, do you still want to go forward with the offer for 199 months, dispositional departure, probation?
I don't believe that was explicitly asked, no. So I think, but I think it would, just to answer Judge Wheelock's question about getting to the prejudice and how appellant just cannot establish prejudice, and that's why this claim fails. I also believe they can't establish deficient performance under the first prong. But it is looking at that the outcome of the plea negotiation and would not have been different. As Judge Connolly mentioned earlier, just the practical realities of plea negotiations, you know, really the practical options here were probation or an executed sentence. Everyone was fully understood and was aware that it was going to be a sentence of 55 months if he went the executed route.
You know, the and that's a fair comment, Ms. Light, but I mean, I'm not so sure I would want to sign on to an opinion that said, you know, it's irrelevant what he's pleading to, it's irrelevant whether it was a proper sentence or not. 55 was the number versus probation. That's the only thing that really matters, and it doesn't really matter about anything else. It seems to me then we are getting into, and whether that's a general, I mean, I'd be the first to admit that generally speaking, defendants only care about the number and not what particular thing they're pleading to, but that's them, not us. And here, I do have a concern that, you know, this wasn't the finest hour. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure I want to say no prejudice, no ineffective assistance of counsel, no harm versus let's have an evidentiary hearing and let's see what everybody has to say. And then you've got a stronger record to, okay, they were never going to give him 50. They were never, it was never going to happen. Mm-hmm. No one was going to give him that. And then either he'll testify or not about as to whether, well, you know, maybe I would have reconsidered or something. But I guess I'm not so sure what the harm is to simply having an evidentiary hearing to clear up what was not exactly a pure sentencing in Hennepin County.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, yes. I mean, I believe looking at the record on its face, I believe that the post-conviction court did not abuse its discretion because appellant failed to allege facts that would entitle him to relief even if proven at this evidentiary hearing. And so I don't believe that this court, you know, should find an abuse of discretion. I understand Your Honor's point. You know, evidentiary hearings are helpful. They provide a clear, full, factual
record. Well,
actually,
sometimes they're not.
So, you know, if that, you know, I think that's so, the full extent of the relief.
Your bottom line is he was going to take probation, and it could have been 25 months, it could have been 55 months, it could have been 75 months. It's absolutely clear from this record that he was going to take probation, therefore no harm, no foul. And that's what he got. He got probation.
True. My position is also that 25 months was never on the table and would never be on the table, and that's also clear from the record. We never offered anything below 60 prior to this last negotiation. And it also just doesn't make logical sense that we would offer 199 months stayed, be on probation, monitoring conditions for 5 years, or we know that you have 17 months credit right now. We're just letting you have immediate release, no further monitoring, no conditions.
But it really, I mean, with 17 months, it's 55 months, not divisible by 3, of course. So what is that?
No, so I should clarify. I guess I mean, I take appellant's argument to be because he rejected the 55 months, but he's saying if he had the opportunity to plead to 25 months, he would have taken that, is how I read and understand appellant's argument. What I'm saying is that there's no prejudice because that never was an option and never would have been.
One case I'm thinking of, because, I mean, when we're talking about guilty pleas here, we're talking about waiving your right to a trial. And then the little case, defendant provided a waiver of his right to trial, like on a Friday. On Monday, the state amended the charge to an offense that would have a much greater prison sentence. And the district court said, do we need a waiver? And defense counsel said, nope, we waived right to a jury trial. On Friday, we don't need to do that again. This court said, nope, you don't need another waiver. The Supreme Court disagreed and said, okay, when you waive your right to a jury trial, and then they amend the charge, increasing the potential consequence, you need to know that to make sure you still want to waive your right to trial. Doesn't that same principle apply here, where it's like you waived your right to trial, agree to plead guilty based on these known facts? It turns out the facts are different. Isn't there an opportunity, or shouldn't there be some sort of inquiry of the defendant to say, do you still want to go forward with this, knowing that when you structured this deal, the facts were wrong?
Well, I believe the facts were not wrong. I think they were just operating under a, you know, they just hadn't clarified which severity level this crime was on the grid. So the facts were all the same. The charges were never amended. It was just when that email was sent.
The facts were different in the sense that he was thinking option two was 55 months. And then the question becomes, okay, well, now that we know the facts are different in terms of criminal history score, is 55 months still the state's best offer, or the state willing to renegotiate? And I hear what you're saying, no chance of that. But that's a factual determination, and we have no record on which to make that, nor did the district court. It all seems to be a lot of assumptions, well-founded assumptions, but, you know, from two people who spent a lot of time in that court, but we still don't have a record that supports it.
And I see my time is up. I would just maintain the state's position that appellant failed to allege sufficient facts to support that claim to get to a hearing, and that's our position. Thank you.
I don't see any additional questions. Rebuttal?
Mr. Withall, if you could begin by addressing the prejudice. Can you hear me okay? Mm-hmm. If you could begin by addressing the prejudice prong of the Strickland test, that would be helpful.
The prejudice prong looks at whether there is a reasonable likelihood that the outcome would have been different but for the professional error. The outcome here is the defendant's choice to accept the state's offer for option one and reject the state's offer for option two. So when I'm looking at the scope of the prejudice analysis, I'm looking at counsel's error in misadvising on the presumptive sentence for option two in the context of the defendant, Mr. Lewis, choosing whether to accept one or the other or reject both and proceed to trial.
Explain to me why your analysis does not depend on the state offering your client 25 months. I mean, I get it. If he was looking at 25 months versus however many months was in probation, I can see your client making a conscious decision, you know, it's not that long. Who knows what's going to happen on probation? I'm done. But the state is main. There's nothing in the record to suggest the state was ever going to offer your client 25 months. So how does, I mean, you're saying it would have been different, and I'm saying, how can you prove that when there's no evidence in the record they ever would have offered 25 months?
It goes to the defendant's decision-making process. When defendants are deciding whether or not a state's offer is a good deal, they need to understand what the presumptive sentence is. They need to understand if the state's offer is reasonable in the context of what the law permits the court to impose.
But if he would have, even at 55 months with good time and the 17 months credit, he's only going in for 20 months. So, I mean, if he's looking at it that way, it's like, oh, do I risk 199 months, less a third, less the good time, or I'm done in 20 months?
great fact question for the post-conviction court. I mean, I don't know what's in his head. I know what we put in the post-conviction petition based on my conversation with my client and the factual allegations that we made, and he said he wouldn't have pleaded guilty had he been properly advised. So when we're talking about prejudice in the context of the professional error, he's saying he would have made a different decision, and that's a credibility determination for the post-conviction court.
And what would his decision have been? Did he say that in his petition? Had I known that the presumptive sentence was 25 months on the negotiated charge, I wouldn't have taken the deal for probation. We don't know.
With my remaining 2 minutes, I block quoted in my brief. It's in my post-conviction petition. Okay. I would ask the court to review that. I think it's an important answer to that question. A couple of things I wanted to highlight about.
But just so I'm clear, that the correction of the criminal history point put us in a position where he was either agreeing to probation and 199 months hanging over his head or walking out of jail with no probation because he had credit. Well, no, he'd have supervised release conditions, but.
And let me tell you about this offer. I mean, if you look at the grid and the way that they were getting to 199 months under their erroneous assumption about the severity levels, 199 months is bottom of the box for first-degree criminal sexual conduct based on 4 criminal points.
Okay.
They found out later it was 3.
So what would that box be?
153. I mean, this isn't a rock-solid plea
the
agreement.
Bottom. What's the top? Assume it's over 199, or do we hear
216,
that?
It's over 1. Yeah, they got to the number. I mean, these are rational, you know, factual determinations that the post-conviction court can make. Maybe they conclude, yeah, the state would have found a way to get up to 55 months, like doing a double upward departure, and that's still on the table if we're successful at the post-conviction hearing. But, again, these are kind of factual what-ifs for the post-conviction court to determine after hearing the testimony. The thing that inspires the least amount of confidence in me is the gulf, the difference in facts between what he pled to in option one and what he would have had to admit to in option two. It gives me no confidence in what Mr. Lewis actually did when option one is plead guilty to digitally penetrating someone under 13, and option two is an inchoate offense, a substantial step with the intent to complete sexual contact under attempted criminal sexual conduct in the second degree. I don't really know, based on the record that we will present at the post-conviction hearing, based on the allegations in the petition, what actually happened in this case, so we shouldn't really go forward with the assumption that he did exactly that. I ask this court to reverse for a post-conviction evidentiary hearing because the facts demonstrate that Mr. Lewis is deprived his right to effective assistance of counsel.
All right, doesn't look like we have any additional questions. Thank you for your arguments and briefing. You'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes the court's oral calendar.